The first battle of Jericho was fought about 1400 BC. And it was the Israelites against the Canaanites. And we have the biblical story, the biblical record of this in considerable detail. And do you know how the Israelites came from the east? In fact, they came in the spring, which is the time when the Jordan River is at its flood stage, and God miraculously parted the water for them. So they crossed over, but they weren't yet ready to attack Jericho. They went and held a covenant ceremony near Shechem, renewed the covenant with God, circumcised those who had not been circumcised in the wilderness, and now they were spiritually prepared. So they came to the city of Jericho, which is in the southern Jordan Valley. Here's the Jordan Valley, is the big line, and as you look at the north end of the Dead Sea, which is the blue rectangle at the bottom, it's just off to the left of the upper corner. So Jericho is located at the northwest corner of the Dead Sea. And you know the story about how they marched around the walls once a day for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, they marched around seven times. And then they blew their trumpets, their ram's horns, or whatever they had with them to blow. And the walls fell down. And then they marched on up into the city, each man going before him, it says, and conquered the city, defeated the Canaanites, and God had given this city into their hands. And more than any other battle that they fought, or perhaps equaled one other battle, God demonstrated that He was giving them the promised land by giving them this city as a token, a foretaste of the eventual possession of the entire land of Canaan. And God directly intervened in that way to show them this. Now there is another battle, of course, the battle in the Beth Horon Pass, where the sun stands in the sky, which is also a miraculous intervention. But anyway, there is direct divine intervention at Jericho to give this city into the hands of the Israelites. It would seem, therefore, to be a very simple task. We know where Jericho is. It's very clearly marked. It's very clearly evident. It stands out very well. It has the biggest springs in the southern, in the whole Jordan Valley, right next to the city. That's why the city was built there. So there's no question about where Jericho was located. Now there is a New Testament Jericho. And the New Testament Jericho was not built on top of Old Testament Jericho. It was built 3-4 miles to the south. And so that's an entirely different situation. So when Jesus goes into Jericho and then comes out of Jericho and meets the people there, he is passing through New Testament Jericho. And Old Testament Jericho is a ruined mound. New Testament Jericho is a Roman, it's laid out like, actually it's Herod's palace, really, is what it was. Herod's winter palace was located there. And that's what has been excavated. So that's a different type of archaeology. There's just a one period site from the Roman times, and you can see the walls and so forth, and that's all there is. But here at Jericho, there is one of these large ruin mounds, which goes by the Arabic name of Tell, which means a ruined mound of an ancient city. And these tells were built up by periodic occupation and abandonment, occupation and abandonment. And that's what Jericho looks like. Looking at it from the air, it looks like kind of the shape of a kidney bean. It would seem, therefore, to be a simple matter to just go and dig into Jericho and see the destruction that the Israelites did. Well, as in all things in archaeology, we have to keep these archaeologists employed, you know. And it doesn't turn out to be quite that simple. Now we do know, just to give you the big picture, we do know that the city of Jericho had a major final destruction, and a fairly early major final destruction, sometime in the second millennium BC. In some places the ash is 2 and 3 feet deep. Major destruction. And with that, the life of Old Testament Jericho came to an end. Now Joshua pronounced a curse upon the city. And the curse actually was fulfilled in the time of King Ahab. For it mentions that a man named Hiel went to build on Jericho when Joshua had left the curse that the city should be abandoned. And so Hiel and his family suffered the results of their attempt. But archaeologically, if you look at Jericho, it's a very old city, one of the first cities established in Palestine. And then it came to this drastic, dramatic conflagration that brought it to an end. And so it would be easy to say, and I would say so, the Israelites did it. The problem is they didn't leave a nice stone carved saying Joshua was here. They didn't do that. So you have to fit the pieces of the puzzle together. And one of the big pieces of the puzzle is pottery. Now, clay vessels were the standard household equipment for virtually every household chore in ancient times. There are cooking pots, there's storage jars, there's bowls, there are little pitchers and jugs of all different kinds and shapes. Lamps, they're all made out of pottery. Now the pottery, of course, is kind of fragile, so it breaks. So if you drop one, it breaks. And so when you walk over one of these ruined mounds, you see hundreds, thousands of broken pieces of pottery all over the place. You can pick them up by the handfuls if you want. Because that was the staple use of article in the ancient world, and eventually they all broke and they're scattered around on these places. And so the archaeologist has used pottery as an index. It's the alphabet of archaeology, if you please. And so we looked at pictures of places that may well be Sodom and Gomorrah, and you saw how simple and plain the pottery of that early age was. But it didn't stop there. It went on and it evolved, and they made it more refined and more angles and more beautiful and more paint, and so there is a progression in the development of pottery through time. And this is the alphabet, the language of the archaeologist. And so the way he dates things is he says, well, now this simple bowl comes from the early Bronze Age, this painted bowl comes from the middle Bronze Age, and these red jugs come from the Iron Age. And so there's an alphabet that extends through time. And the real argument among archaeologists today is not over whether there's a big destruction level at the end of Jericho. That is not the argument. The argument is over the pottery. What date does the pottery point to? Jericho has been excavated 3 times. The first time was by the Germans, just before World War I. In those days, archaeology was in its infancy. Relatively little was known about the details of pottery chronology. They did do a very interesting thing in that they cleared at least a quarter of the wall around the city, and we will look at pictures of that. That was very helpful and illustrates a part of the Bible story. Then a man named John Garstang came to Jericho. He worked there from 1930 to 1936. And he said, Jericho's walls fell in 1400 BC, and I have the pottery and I have the Egyptian objects which date it to that date. This was done by Joshua. Well, that's a pretty strong substantiation of the Bible. And some critical scholars don't like the Bible to be supported quite that well. So another British expedition went back there after World War II It was led by a woman. Her name was Kathleen Kenyon. And Miss Kenyon said, this final big destruction of the city belonged to the date of 1550 B.C. Joshua didn't have anything to do with it. It was too early for him. An Egyptian army must have come through here and done this destruction. So this is the argument among the archaeologists, and this is the second Battle of Jericho. So what is the date? This is the real question. What is the date of this big final destruction level? 1400 according to Gerstang, or 1550 according to Kathleen Kenyon? Miss Kenyon did a lot of digging. She dug at Jerusalem, she dug at Samaria, she dug at Jericho. And a common failing of archaeologists is they love to dig and they hate to write. And so Miss Kenyon died without completing her report on Jericho. And so her manuscripts in process were turned over to a man who finally finished up these volumes on Jericho. And so we now have the final reports, big thick volumes with all the diagrams of all the digging and all the pottery that was found. And so now we can check her results. This has been done by, especially carefully, a man who's made a special study of Jericho, by somebody who lives relatively near close to you. His name is Bryant Wood. He's a Presbyterian. He has a PhD in archaeology from the University of Toronto, and he lives in Harrisburg. So he's not too far from me. Maybe I ought to have him up here sometime to show his slides of Jericho. Actually, I got these slides from him, so. So I'm a stand-in, really, for Bryant Wood. Now, what Bryant Wood did was this. He says, now we have the pottery plates, and we can go and study these and see just what this final destruction really dates to. And from his detailed study, he has come to the conclusion, and I think he's correct on the basis of his analysis, that the pottery really points to the year or the approximate time of 1400 B.C., It was the work of Joshua. Now, what is the problem, or what is the object for discussion there? Miss Kenyon said that Jericho was not occupied in 1400 B.C., and she said that on the basis of the absence of a particular kind of pottery. She said there is a certain type of pottery. It's called bichrome ware, which means that two kinds of paint were used on it. So these jars and jugs are painted with red and black paint. None of it was found by Kathleen Kenyon at Jericho. Now this pottery is characteristic and specific for the 15th century B.C. And she says none of it's here, therefore the city was not occupied in 15th century B.C. Well, be careful. There is something known in history and archaeology and Bible studies as an argument from silence. She's arguing about what she didn't find instead of what she did find. Now, in her time, the early 1950s, the local pottery of this period, what is known as the Late Bronze Age, the local pottery was not known very well. In fact, it's rather poorly made pottery. You see, it isn't a straight line evolution of pottery, but it's an up and down type of thing, and sometimes they made very nice pottery, and sometimes they made rather poor pottery. In fact, my professor at Harvard said he called it sewer ware, the Late Bronze Age pottery, because it's pretty poor stuff. And now, 25 years later, we know this local made pottery better. And we can see the local made pottery from the Late Bronze Age in her pottery plates, even though she did not recognize that that was what they were. So it looks like the pottery arguments are going in favor of Professor Wood. Now, what about the absence of bichrome ware? Bichrome ware, we now know, came from the island of Cyprus. You know, the archaeologists have a way of doing what is called neutron activation analysis, where you shoot beams through the pottery and it gives you the chemical characteristic of the clay. And the clay of this painted pottery is not local clays of Palestine, it's clay from Cyprus. So this painted pottery was imported. Now, who has imported pottery, vessels, and materials that come in those vessels? The upper class, the rich people, the kings. Now, it turns out that Professor Garstang actually found some of this pottery, but he didn't know what it was at the time, back in the 1930s. And Bryant Wood, from Harrisburg here, has gone, amazing, intrepid explorer, he's gone to Liverpool in England, he's gone to the Louvre in Paris, and he's gone to the Rockefeller Museum in Israel that you saw on the screen yesterday afternoon, and he has looked at Professor Garstang's pottery bags. That's a pretty dull, dusty chore. But when he did, he found two sets of bichrome ware. Now, how could this be possible, that Professor Garstang would dig up bichrome ware and Kathleen Kenyon would not? It has to do with where you dig. And Professor Garstang, since he got there first, he got some of the choice places to dig, and he excavated the palace. And the painted pottery of the luxury goods were found in the palace. Now, by the time Kathleen Kenyon came there, 25 years later, the palace has already been dug. She can't do anything there. So she digs next door to it. And next door to it is the residential area. And these are homes of people who were much poorer than the king. And so they're not expected to have nice luxury goods like this in their homes. So there's an explanation and a reason for why bichrome ware was not found in Kathleen Kenyon's dig, because she was digging in poor people's houses, and an explanation for why Garstang did find it, because he's digging in the palace, and that's where the imported luxury goods go to the king. So that's the pottery argument. And so that turn of the screw will turn off the lights and we'll look at some pictures. We start with a map of Palestine, and again, you can see the general location of Jericho. It's kind of at the wide place at the bottom of the Jordan Valley, just at the north end of the Dead Sea, and it's on the left or west-hand side of the river. So the Israelites crossed the river to get to Jericho. And so here's an artist's conception of the people of Israel, the soldiers of Israel, having marched around the city seven times on the seventh day, and they're blowing their ram's horns and trumpets, and the walls are crumbling before them. Now, there's an interesting question about whether the walls fell inward or the walls fell outward. Now, I don't know exactly where the idea got started that the walls fell inward, but in actuality, as the archaeologist now demonstrates, the walls fell outwards. And that served two major purposes for the Israelite soldiers. Number one, when you knock down the walls, you knock down the Canaanite defenses of the city. But number two, when you knock them down outwards, what you really have done is provided a ramp for the soldiers to march up into the city. So, and that's what we will see archaeologically here. So here's the picture. Here's an artist's conception. There's one thing wrong with it. They're still marching around the city in this case. There's one thing wrong, and that is not enough of the wall has fallen. But the artist has to do it this way to kind of give you an idea of what the standing wall would have looked like and what the fallen wall... Well, we'll say the walls are just starting to fall. Now, there's another interesting feature of this picture, which is borne out by the archaeology, and you'll notice the houses in this picture, and you'll notice to the right or above the houses, there's another wall. So Jericho actually had two walls. It had a double wall. It had a lower wall. It had a foundation, a lower wall, a plastered slope, and an upper wall. And that's all the more difficult for the Israelite soldiers to get in. But when the wall fell, both of these walls fell. Some of it fell down the slope, and some of it fell into the trough below the wall. At the north end of the city, not in other places, there were houses which were built between the double walls. Now that becomes of interest when we think about the story of Rahab and the spies. Because the spies go to her house for protection, and then she lets them down over the city wall. Now in order to have done that, she should have had a house fairly close to the city wall. And indeed, that is what the archaeologists found at the north end of the city only. So here you see the wall crumbling, and you see some of the houses there. They're beginning to shake too. And you see the upper wall, it's already got a big notch that's been knocked into it. So the picture of the idea of the two walls and the houses between the wall fits the Rahab story very nicely. Well, here's John Garstang. I used to have a picture of Kathleen Kenyon, too. I don't know where that picture went, but anyway, here's John Garstang working there in the 1930s. He lived till the late 1940s, and he came to the United States during World War II and ended his career at the University of Chicago. And he's holding a jar, which is an anthropoid juglet, meaning that it's man-shaped. But it's also rather bizarre, as you can see. And so he has these large looped ears and big eyes and a little narrow chin and a beard. And so we call that jar Mr. Jericho. This is an aerial view of Jericho. And you can follow the road that goes up the east side of the city. And the spring, where it dips in towards the city, you can't see it. I can't even see it. You can't see it on this slide. But that's where the springs of the city were. And that's also about the location where the city gate was. Now the palace is on the right-hand side, just a little farther up. There's a big square cut there. That's the palace area. And so the palace was located near the springs and near the city gate. Now, if you come around, you can see the outer circumference of the city, and then you can see some big lines cut in it. And those big lines that have been cut into this mound are the archaeologist's trenches. The idea is the archaeologist cuts a trench, and when he cuts that trench down, he or she gets a cross-section of the occupation periods as you go down through. And so this is the way archaeology has carved up the ancient mound of Jericho. I'm sorry this is a little dark, but this is an archaeological map of the town. And the colors represent the three different groups who have excavated here. And the blue is what the Germans did before World War I. And the really important and interesting part is if you look at the upper end on the left, you see a large curve. That's the outer wall of the city. And you'll also see a big patch of blue just inside that. That's the residential area between the walls, which gives us a nice example or idea about Rahab's house. Now, if you come down on the right-hand side, you'll see a large patch of red in the right lower area. A large patch of red with four little yellow squares. The large patch of red is where Garstang excavated the palace of Jericho. And the four yellow squares are where Kathleen Kenyon dug next to it. But the difference here is that she was digging outside of the palace and he was digging inside of the palace, and that made a difference in terms of the pottery that they both mutually or severally excavated or found. Now these are Egyptian objects. These are what are called scarabs. They were considered to be a little magic amulet. And as a token of respect for the dead, these were sometimes buried with the dead. There, again, are semi-precious objects, especially to people who lived in Canaan, and these were imported from Egypt. And there are names. The top of it is carved like a beetle, and the bottom of it has a flat surface in which names are written in hieroglyphs. And there are names of three pharaohs here. This is a series of scarabs which was found from the tombs. Now, the tombs were not on this mound. The tombs were dug by the people of ancient Jericho into the hillside to the west of the city. And from those tombs, when they excavated the pottery and the bones and what have you, they found these scarabs. Garstang found these scarabs. And these scarabs date to three Egyptian pharaohs. The name of the one on the upper left is Thutmose III. Actually, it has his... Egyptian pharaohs had five names, not one, but five. And so his particular name is Menheferre, and that's Thutmose III. Thutmose III reigned in the first half of the 15th century B.C. Then the one on the lower right is the scarab of a woman named Hatshepsut, very famous English Egyptian queen. I'm thinking of the English excavator. Egyptian queen who eventually became an Egyptian king. She made herself king. She put herself on the throne when her husband died, and her stepson, Thutmose III, was just a little shaver of 6 years of age. And so she put herself on the throne as king. So here's not just a queen, but a female king. And she ruled contemporaneously with Thutmose III for 25 years in the first half of the 15th century B.C. Then the other scarab is that on the lower left, is that of Amenhotep III. Amenhotep III reigned for about 30 years, and his reign overlapped the end of the 15th century and the beginning of the 14th century. So here we have a series of three scarabs, and I think the next one is a drawing of these, a series of three scarabs that belong to three kings of Egypt whose scarabs found their way to Jericho and were buried there where the burials in Jericho. And the dates of these three scarabs belong to the 15th century B.C. And so Professor Garstang, on the basis of this, since the last pharaoh is ruling at the time when the biblical date for the conquest of Jericho comes, 1400 B.C., since Amenhotep III was ruling there, he says this is a nice series, and it cuts off. We found no more scarabs after 1400 B.C. So that's part of the reason, not all of the reason, but part of the reason why Professor Garstang said that the date of the destruction of Jericho is 1400 B.C., Now, Miss Kenyon had an argument. She says, well, these are heirlooms, and heirlooms are passed down from generation to generation, so we really don't know when these were used. Well, there's an interesting phenomenon. She excavated some tombs also, and her tombs are from an earlier period. And there were about five different sets or groups in her tombs, and she found some scarabs too. And how did she date her tombs? By scarabs. Now, it's the old proverb. What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If Ms. Kenyon's scarabs are valid for using for dating, then so are Garstang's. If Garstang's are not useful, then neither are Ms. Kenyon's. You need to be consistent here. As a matter of fact, I think that both are useful for dating. The tombs that Kathleen Kenyon excavated come from an earlier period. We call it the period of the Hyksos kings in Egypt. And that's a couple centuries earlier than this. But here we have scarabs from the 15th century B.C. and that dates the deaths in the tombs down to a period of 1400 B.C. and then there's an end of the series. This is the palace area. It was partially excavated by the Germans, and it was also excavated by Garstang. And so it's from this area then that the bichrome ware was found. And this is just a close-up of one of the rooms in the palace. And if we had really good lighting and the picture was a really good one, you could see ash on the floors of some of these rooms from the final burning of the city. Now here's the local pottery. This is the local pottery that Miss Kenyon did not know well. and which has been recognized somewhat better now over the last 25 years. And these are the forms of the pottery. These are unpainted. Now, two or three of them do have some decorations, but most of the rest are unpainted. And so it's rather plain pottery, rather simple pottery, but it's pottery which belongs to the Late Bronze Age, and it belongs to the period of what we would call Late Bronze I, which is the 15th century B.C. So this is the local pottery that now helps to establish the date of the final destruction and puts it in the end of the 15th century rather than the middle of the 16th century. The light is not better, but some people up the middle at least might see the red and black paint on these objects. This is bichrome ware, which has been dug out of the bags of Professor Garstang in the museums by Bryant Wood. As I mentioned, he visited three different museums, and here, and I think this is the bag from Liverpool, and here he found, let's see, what is it, 8 pieces. And you can see the black paint, and in some places you can see the red paint. On the left lower sherd, you can see red and black bands. So this is bichrome ware of the 15th century B.C. And so if Miss Kenyon had dug through Professor Garstang's pottery bags, she might have been a little more accurate in terms of her judgment about the occupation of Jericho during the 15th century B.C. So here's some more. This is, I guess, from the Louvre in Paris. Again, in the middle piece in the bottom, you can see the red and black bands. This is bichrome ware from Jericho. We're moving now to the north end of the city. At the north end of the city is the place where the houses of the city were built up against the outer wall. The outer wall of the city is at the top of the slide. And then you see the floor plans of the houses. Now the houses don't remain, but the stumps of the walls are still there. And so the stumps of the walls show you the distribution of these houses. And then at the bottom of the slide, you can't see it, it's off the slide, is another wall of the upper city. So these are the houses that were built between the walls. And it's in a house like this, then, that Rahab would have lived and would have been able to lower the spies over the wall, out of the wall, out of the city, out of the way of harm. And then, of course, when the Canaanite king and his troops come to her house and ask, you know, where are they? And she says, they've gone. They went back that away. And she points them towards the river, whereas the spies went towards the hills. So in so doing, she saved their lives. This is this is the palace area, which shows you the floor plan of these buildings, and you can see there's a lot of interconnection between the rooms, and I think the area in the center was excavated by Garstang, and the shaded area up at the top was excavated by Kenyon. And so there's a difference in the place where the archaeologists dug, and as a consequence, a difference in their results. Now this is the north end of the city. This was cleared by the Germans before World War I, and if you look at the right lower corner of the slide, you'll see a large wall there. That's the foundation wall. There's a foundation wall, and then there's the superstructure of the wall. Only a little of it survives. And you might see a layer or two of bricks above that above the foundation that is part of the superstructure of the wall. So they had the big, deep foundational wall, and then the superstructure built above it, and inside it were built these houses. So this is a photograph taken before World War I of the houses at the north end of the city of Jericho, and the houses showing these houses being built up against the edge of the city. And once again, if we could see more clearly at the left upper corner, you could actually see fragments left from the upper wall. So this is a double wall. So this is what the wall of Jericho looked like to the approaching Israelite troops. And so we have a little Israelite soldier standing there at the bottom. He looks at the foundation of the wall. He looks at the superstructure of the lower wall. Then he looks at the slope. And then he looks at the upper wall. Now, if God had not intervened, the Israelite troops would have had to fight their way up over the lower wall, or through it some way, up the slope, and remember there's soldiers stationed on top of both of these walls firing down at the Israelites. They would have had to fight their way up the slope and then up over or through the upper wall to get into the city. So it's a rather impressive defensive system. You remember the story of the spies that were sent out 40 years before this happened, and they came back and said, oh, they have great, huge, high walls on their cities, and we'll never be able to conquer these. Well, you can see this is a pretty formidable obstacle, and probably the Canaanites inside the city felt relatively secure, except for those strange maneuverings of the Israelites outside as they marched around the city. Now, this is the picture of the foundation, or I should say the cross-section or the drawing of the foundation wall. All three expeditions have found this wall. On the left, you see the German excavation of the wall, and you see the foundation is in the dark black going down to the right, and the superstructure, some of the bricks up at the top. In the middle is Professor Garstang's excavation of it. Again, you see the foundation stones and the superstructure with the mud bricks up at the top. And at the far right, you see a little more detailed drawing from Kathleen Kenyon, and you see how some of the debris fell from the walls also. But basically, it's the same picture all three of them show, with this big, deep block, stone block foundation and the mud brick superstructure. And this is from Kathleen Kenyon's excavation, showing the footing of this wall, the foundation part. And this is the same thing from Garstang's time. You can see there's a man, let's say he's 6 feet tall. You can see how high and deep that foundation wall was. It would not have been an easy barrier to get over and up above and on top of. So this is the foundation wall of the defenses of the city. Now, here's what the archaeology shows about the conquest and destruction. The yellow part in the middle of the slide is the fill that is in behind the foundation of the outer wall. The outer wall is marked by a black line at the left side of the yellow. That is the foundation part. Those blocks are still there. The foundation of the wall remained. But the superstructure is missing. The superstructure of that wall and the bricks from the superstructure that were present at one time are now fallen down in and are debris in the red triangular area below the wall. And so this is the archaeological evidence that shows that. Now, that, remember, this is from Miss Kenyon, and she's not trying to prove anything. She's just trying to find what's there. She doesn't really believe Joshua did it, but it's a perfect fit for Joshua. And so as the mud brick superstructure falls outwards, it creates a ramp. And so when the Bible says that every man went straight up before him into the city, you can see why and how. Because they have this perfect ramp leading right up from them on into the city. And here's the burn layer. Sorry that the slide is not very clear, but you'll notice the brown soil up above, which is debris which has washed in. But down below, you'll notice the gray, ashy area. And this is in one of the rooms of one of the houses. And this gray, ashy area represents the burn of the city, which the Israelites burnt after they conquered it. And then the soil, the brown part, is soil that has washed over it through the centuries that the city has stood unoccupied. And here's Bryant Wood, our explorer of Jericho, and he's pointing to some of this ash. Not too clear to see in this particular picture, but it illustrates some of the tumbled wall and some of the ash that's present there. I think that's our last. Well, here's another artist conception of the houses again, and the houses that are between the walls and up against the outer wall. And they're cracking with the earthquake, and so the artist has even provided us with an up-close view of what Rahab's house would have been like and how it would have happened. And so here are the stands of flax on the roof, as is mentioned in the Bible. And so the steps up to the roof. Roofs and houses in ancient times and even modern Israel are commonly used today. It's a nice place to cool off in the evening and so forth. and then the house is built up against the wall, so it's easy enough to get over to the wall and to be let down the wall. And here you see the artist's conception of the foundation wall down below and the mud brick superstructure up above and the house behind it. This is the debris that washed down from the destruction. Remember, this ruin mound has stood empty for, 1400 BC to 3500 years approximately. And so the rains have washed all this debris. And the yellow debris is debris that was washed down from the late Bronze Age. And the red area is where some of the burned brick underneath it fell. And then the debris, the yellow debris washes over it down the slope. Well, this is a final point about Jericho, and that is to do with how... Well, let me back up a little bit and just say one of the common ways in which to conquer ancient cities was what is known as siege warfare. Siege warfare. In siege warfare, you would put your army around the city, and that army would be in place until you starved the people out of the city. And of course, they began to starve when their food ran out. And the question is, how much food was there in Jericho at the time it was conquered and destroyed? These are storage jars. And these storage jars, some of them have already been cleaned, but already in one near the bottom and one on the left and the top, and maybe another one on the right upper side, they still have grain in them. Grain that has been covered over with dirt, but there were actually quite a bit of grain was found in the storage jars that were excavated in other places on this ruin mound in at the time. So there was quite a bit of food supplies on hand in the city at the time it was conquered. In other words, the city was conquered directly by attack and conquest rather than by siege warfare. If it was siege warfare, then all of these jars would have been empty. The people would have been starved out. Now, what does that have to do with the biblical story? It has to do with the time of year in which the Israelites conquered Jericho. When did they conquer Jericho? What time of the year? And the answer is in the spring. They left Egypt in the spring, time of Passover, and they crossed the Jordan River at the time of Passover, a year later, or 40 years later, 41 years later, I should say. And so it's springtime again. Now, in the Jordan Valley, growing grain is like growing grain in a hothouse. The grain in the Jordan Valley comes in much sooner than the grain on the slopes of the western slope. And so their harvest takes place considerably earlier. February, March, whereas April and May are the times for harvesting in the hill country. And so the people of Jericho were not starved out. They had already harvested their grain for that year, and they had the grain stored in storage jars on hand when the Israelites came. And so the burned grain in these jars is another token of how well the archaeological data fits together with the biblical story. Yes, that's as much as I wish to say about Jericho, but maybe I'll summarize and then I'll take your question. Okay, let me just point out that the geography of the ruin mound fits very nicely with the biblical story. The pottery now is recognized to fit very well with the biblical story. The layout of the city in terms of where the houses were located, for letting the spies down out over the wall fits very well with the biblical story. The pottery found in the palace fits well with the biblical story. The great burn across the tell fits very well. The fallen walls, which fell out and made a ramp for the soldiers to go up into the city. So I would say that at the present time we have a very nice fit between the archaeological data and the biblical record. Okay, we have a question here and then a question back there. No, it's not that big. It's more like It's not a large city. It's about 12 acres in size. It's under half a mile long, north to south, and it's under a quarter mile width wide. So it's not a real big city. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did they ever find bones scattered around in places other than in the tomb, indicating that there was a
slaughter? They did not find. Your question is an interesting one, one that could deserve some further exploration. They didn't find bones on the floors of the houses. Of course, there's bones in the tombs, but those go back, you know, to the time preceding the city. So one would guess, you know, what would the Israelites do with this place? Well, maybe they left the bodies there to burn, but maybe they put him in a mass grave someplace. That, if so, that mass grave has not yet been found. But one would expect it would be in the vicinity of this place. So there are ways to do subsurface probes without digging. You know, you can do subsurface radar. We'll go down about 20 feet, probe in the area to see if some mass grave might not be found. But to the present time, no. Those bodies of the people who died in the final siege and attack have not been found. Yes. They are, that's right. And the question is, the springs across the modern road from the ancient ruin of Jericho, are these the springs of Elisha? You remember he threw his axe in the waters to sweeten them or something like that? And that's correct. That is where this action took place also. Yes, they sure are. It's the most copious spring, most abundant water supply in the entire Jordan, fresh water, non-river water, in the entire Jordan Valley. They're still using it today. Jericho, in particular, is a location for citrus growth. And so you have a lot of orange groves around, and those orange groves are irrigated from that spring. In fact, the people of Jericho, and I'm inclined to agree with them, that the sweetest oranges in the Holy Land come from Jericho. You know, they raise a lot of oranges, or used to raise a lot of oranges down near Tel Aviv, but they're not as sweet as the Jericho oranges. Yes?
With the structure of the housing inside the wall, did they give any indication that they were destroyed, similar to how a wall was destroyed? So, I mean, had the wall falling down, you'd think that if it was an earthquake or something, it would affect the housing also.
Yes. Well, the way, as you can see, some of these houses were built up against the city wall. And as a matter of fact, the wall of the city actually is the interior wall of the house. And so when the wall fell, the one wall of the house falls and then the rest of the stuff falls in. There is evidence. Now, sometimes you get a really neat picture of an earthquake when you see a large fractured rock. There is a case of that nearby here at Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were written. And there's a stairway down to a cistern that's cracked like that. Now here all you get are, you know, you do get rock falls, but you don't get any of these nice long cracks across the tell that would indicate how the earthquake occurred. We have two alternatives here. You know, the question, in a sense, it seems like to me your question hinges a little bit upon how God does miracles. You know, did he just touch Jericho and shake it, or did he touch the fault in the Jordan Valley and make that shake and then make an... I don't think we could archaeologically tell the difference.
I was just wondering if the walls collapsed and not necessarily had the same effect on the houses inside. The walls were collapsing, but not the houses.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. My recollection, I'd have to go over the reports to really answer your question fairly and accurately, but my recollection is there is some evidence for falling rock inside the city. So it wouldn't be exclusive to the city walls. But let me simply point out that in either case, if God directly touched these walls, or if he touched the fault line in the Jordan Valley and made an earthquake do this, in either case, it's supernatural. Because it just so let us say it's a regular earthquake of the Jordan Valley. It just so happened that the quake, the plate slipped when they blew the trumpet the seventh time. Yes, ma'am.
I think we're told that
Could be. Okay. That may be. I don't recollect that, but perhaps. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. There is one cuneiform tablet has been found in the excavations. It is very badly damaged. Only about 6 or 7 of the signs are legible, and you can't make out what the message or what the writing of it is about. Sad story. There probably was more. There may well be more. There may be an archive hidden in this mountain still. You know, you can see, really, we've had 3 major excavations. And each of those excavations has dug for several years. And you can see from the, if you remember the colored map at the beginning, they've done a little more than scratch the surface, but there's, let's say they've excavated 20% if they've done that. And so there's a lot more of the city that could contain a lot more interesting historical information. I doubt that any more excavations will be carried out here for a long time to come. There's a lot more. You know, what happens, the more you dig, you get into a law of diminishing returns. You know, it takes about 3 to 5 seasons to really learn a city well. And then the archaeologist quits. He says, I know about as much as I'm going to learn out of this city. Mm-hmm. Now, I still have 20 minutes. I'm going to keep you that long. And I'm going to talk about arcs. And so, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, the most common question I get, so I'm prepared for you. I'm ready. And I'm going to tell you right where the ark is. Oh, I wish. But I really am telling you this as a precaution. I'm talking first about the Ark of the Covenant. There has been some excitement in some Adventist churches by people who have been circulating around saying the Ark of the Covenant has been found. Now, let me warn you that I know of 7 different groups in the Middle East who have been looking for the Ark of the Covenant, and to my knowledge, from what they have produced, none of them has found the Ark of the Covenant. So I'm going to tell you some of these stories. Several of them involve Seventh-day Adventists. There was a man named Larry Blauser who lived in the city of Denver. Larry Blauser believed, for reasons that aren't clear to me, that the Ark of the Covenant was hidden down near Ein Gedi. Ein Gedi is a spring. It's a nature preserve, a nature park today, on the west side of the Dead Sea. But he thought the Ark of the Covenant was hidden in David's cave. And so David's cave is supposed to be the cave in which Saul threw the spear at David and it hit the wall and missed David. And so Larry Blauser had the idea that that was where the Ark of the Covenant was hidden. Now, the Ark of the Covenant was hidden in 586 B.C. as Nebuchadnezzar's troops either encircled or approached the city of Jerusalem. Jeremiah and the priests took the Ark of the Covenant and hid it wherever they hid it. Unfortunately, neither the Bible nor 1 Maccabees nor Ellen White tells us where. So Larry Blauser had this idea that it was down near the Dead Sea. So he got some geoseismic testing equipment from geologists. He took 2 geologists with him. They went to this area in the Dead Sea. He had a permit from the Department of Antiquities and a permit from the Park Department, because this is a nature preserve. And he set up, the way you do this is you fire off a charge and you have geophones that listen for the sound as it bounces through the rock. And when it bounces through the rock, if it hits a cavity, it makes a different change in the sound and a different change in the way the sound bounces. And so he set up these 2 geophones and did that testing and came to the conclusion that there was a particular cave in a particular area where he thought the ark would be hidden. He came home to the United States, prepared a second expedition to go back and open it up. When he got back there, they take their equipment, the picks and shovels and so on and so forth, and all they did was bend and break them against solid rock. So it turns out that there was not a cave there, at least not a cave that opened to the outside of the rock. And so they went back and looked to see what the problem might have been, and the problem is this. When you are doing geological seismic testing, you have to have your geophones set on solid rock. And it turned out that they had these listening devices set on gravel. And they hadn't noticed it. It's a composite that looked kind of solid, but they were not set on solid rock. They did not give accurate readings, and so the cave didn't exist, or at least there is no direct scientific evidence of a cave in that area, and so the whole expedition came to naught. The second story involves a group, non-Adventist group, called the Holy Ground Changing Mission, a Christian commune which at one time was located in Texas and then moved to Kansas City. Now, the only literary reference that we have as to where the Ark was hidden is in 2 Maccabees, which says that it was hidden or taken to Mount Nebo. I misspoke a little earlier when I said that there was no literary reference. There is one literary reference. The question is about the accuracy of the reference, because 1 Maccabees is considered to be a very accurate historical document. 2 Maccabees is considered to be much less accurate, much more fraught with historical inaccuracies and theological mistakes. In fact, 2 Maccabees is where the Catholics get purgatory from. So, 2 Maccabees, the less reliable book, says that Mount Nebo, across the Jordan River, is where the Ark was taken. Now, this Holy Ground Changing Mission group went up on Mount Nebo, contrary to the request of the Jordanian government. They don't want tourists around in that area because, as I mentioned yesterday, that's a military area that confronts Israel. Maybe it's a little more peaceful now. But at any rate, they went up there and they prospected around on Mount Nebo and they found a cave and they went in and they took some photographs of something that looked kind of blurry like gold or something like that, and then they backed out and got scared. And so they were advertising that they had pictures of the Ark of the Covenant. So Siegfried Horn, who was still alive at that time, was given a plane ticket to go to Kansas City to examine their photographs. And when he got there to look at their photographs, there were a little holding back about it, but finally they showed them to him. And what he saw was there was a shiny surface on the box, but there were also nails of the type that had not been used until the 19th century A.D. Now, what is it if it isn't the Ark of the Covenant? There is a monastery on Mount Nebo, a monastery which is dedicated to Moses because this is the place where he died and, as we know, was translated to heaven from. And though the monks have lived there for centuries and centuries, and so they bury their dead in caves and graves that they excavate along the walls or surfaces of this mountain. And so probably what they stumbled upon was one of these burial caves in which a casket of one of these monks had been placed. That's my guess of what they stumbled across. At any rate, the archaeological dating of the object is pretty modern. Now, the third person looking for the Ark of the Covenant, I heard his name a number of times. I can't remember it. He's not an Adventist. But his approach and technique is to use the treasure scroll. One of the scrolls found among the Dead Sea Scrolls was written on bronze, or copper, not bronze. And so they impressed all this Hebrew writing in this. And in this, it's called the treasure scroll because it gives the directions to a treasure. Now, archaeologists and linguists have studied this scroll carefully, and they cannot follow the directions. They can't figure out where this goes. But there is a man who believes he knows where it is and what's at the end of the line. Now, the text does not say that the Ark of the Covenant is the treasure. In fact, the text says otherwise. It says gold and silver. But this gentleman, I believe he's a Presbyterian minister, believes that this treasure scroll is the key to finding the Ark. And the general direction is out in the plain of the Jordan Valley north of Jericho. So he has been trying to follow this particular route to find the Ark of the Covenant. To the present time, he hasn't turned up with anything. So he may find some gold and silver. He may find the Ark of the Covenant. He may find none of it. But his attempt seems to me to be very poorly based. The scroll itself does not give good directions. The scroll itself does not say the Ark of the Covenant is there, but that's his theory, and he's welcome to follow it. Probably the most common theory among Israelis is that the Ark of the Covenant, and the rabbis in Israel, in Jerusalem, is that the Ark of the Covenant was hidden underneath the temple. Now, the temple area, which today houses the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Golden Dome and the Silver Dome, is a great large platform that covers quite a few acres, 12, 15 acres, inside the walls, which are the retaining walls of the temple area. Underneath the temple area, underneath the platform, there was a large number of tunnels that were cut. You could call them catacombs. And some of those tunnels and catacombs had been sealed up for centuries. Little by little, our rabbis and the archaeologists have been opening those tunnels. This is one of the few cases in which the archaeologists and the rabbis have been able to cooperate. Usually they're fighting with each other because the rabbis feel that the archaeologists are digging up the bones of Jews and this is a desecration and so on and so forth. But at any rate, little by little, they are opening these tunnels under the temple platform, and it's kind of a catacombs down there. And so the theory is that perhaps the Ark of the Covenant was hidden under the temple platform in one of these tunnels, in one of these caves, one of these catacombs. And they haven't come across it as yet, but that's the theory upon which the rabbis in Jerusalem are operating. There is another case. Some of you have heard the name of Ron Wyatt. Some of you may have heard Ron Wyatt speak. Ron Wyatt has the theory that the Ark of the Covenant was hidden down a cistern or down in a cave in the Garden Tomb area. The Garden Tomb is where the Protestants kind of believe that Jesus was buried in the tomb temporarily. The Catholics have a Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is inside the city wall. The Garden Tomb is just outside of the city wall near the Damascus Gate, kind of northwest of the old city. The Garden Tomb has a tomb on the kind of back wall of the garden. You come in an entryway, and there's a lovely garden. They've done a very nice job in laying out this garden, growing trees and so forth. And they have some delightful guides who will tell you the whole story of their discovery and why they think this is the tomb of Jesus. But to me, it does not make very good archaeological sense. The tomb does not, to me, appear to be a Roman tomb. It is rather an Iron Age tomb of the 8th or 7th century B.C. And there's a reason why that tomb would be in that place, because right across the street is the École Biblique, which is the French Dominican School of Archaeology. On the grounds of the École Biblique, there is a massive set of very, very luxurious, rich tombs. They look like tombs of the kings. They're not open to the public. They have been photographed and published once, and that's about as much as can be done there. Occasionally, they will give a very private viewing to some high funky funk. But by and large, those tombs are closed. But the point is that there is a very large collection of these royal tombs from the 8th and 7th century, and it looks to me as if the tomb right across the street was simply the outlying edge of that tomb area. Now, how does that affect the story of Jesus? Well, the story of Jesus says that Jesus was buried rather close to where he was crucified. It also says in one of the three Gospels, the three Synoptic Gospels, that he was buried in a freshly cut tomb. Joseph of Arimathea had recently cut his tomb. And so that was the tomb in which Jesus' body was laid. Now, Joseph of Arimathea and Jesus obviously lived in the 1st century A.D. And therefore, any tomb from the 7th century B.C., which this tomb looks like to me, both because of its archaeological layout and structure, and because of its proximity to the tombs across the street, would not fit. Therefore, this would not be the particular tomb of Jesus. Now, that identification of this as the tomb of Jesus is very vital to Ron Wyatt's theory, because he has a theory. Jesus was crucified kind of at the corner of what would be the Garden Tomb area now, and that his blood dripped down through a crack in the rock onto the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, that theory seems a little awkward to me in light of the Bible. What it really is mixing type and antitype. What is the type? The type is you would slaughter the animal and you would take the blood into the earthly sanctuary, and on the Day of Atonement you would sprinkle that blood on the mercy seat. What is the antitype? The antitype is the blood of Jesus, which was shed on the cross, and Jesus figuratively presents that blood to his Father in the heavenly sanctuary. And God accepts the sacrifice which Jesus has made and says, it is enough, it is done. And Jesus' sacrifice is accepted, and we have salvation. Now, to say that the blood of Jesus dripped on the Old Testament Ark of the Covenant and mercy seat is mixing type and antitype. To me, it does not fit. Then there is the question of his excavations. Now, he has dug down there, I would say, for at least 5, if not 6 seasons, short seasons, 2 to 4 weeks at a time. And he's been clearing this cavern, and clearing this cavern, and clearing this cavern. And he's taken people over there saying, we're going to open this up and we're going to find the Ark of the Covenant. But they never do. Now, he supposedly has some photographs that he has taken by way of some tube or pipe or, you know, or reflecting mirrors and what do you call this when the doctors put, I should know this, you know. Endoscope, yeah, okay. Anyway, he says that he's put an endoscope through the wall and he's seen the Ark of the Covenant in there. Well, if that be so, then it's time to bring it out. Now, at one time, he had a permit to dig. At one time, he had the permit from the Israeli Department of Antiquities, and he also had a permit from the Garden Tomb people. Both of those permits have run out. He has never produced the Ark of the Covenant. So, to me, the rest is apocryphal. Archaeology, the whole thing that's going on with all of this Ark of the Covenant type of thing, is really putting archaeology backside too. What a professional archaeologist does is he digs up a site like Jericho and then he reports it. What these 7 different groups are doing is they report that we have found the Ark of the Covenant and now we are going to dig it up. It's backside too. It's not the way professional archaeology is done. So I think his permit has run out and the Garden Tomb is extending the garden into that area. At least that looked like it when I was there last July. Well, there are more. Don't give up. We got 4 more minutes to find the Ark. There is a man who has written a book, a whole book, about how the Ark of the Covenant was taken to Ethiopia. Have you heard this one? Okay, Vidiana too. Well, the story is, you remember Nebuchadnezzar's conquest, and there were 2 groups of Jews. There was the Jews who were taken off to Babylonian exile, and there's a group of Jews that went down to Egypt, and the book of Jeremiah tells us about that group. And so the theory is, this group of Jews took the Ark of the Covenant with them down to Egypt, and in the 5th century B.C., we know that some of these Jews were working as mercenary soldiers serving the Persian army at an island way down in southern Egypt. So you see, the Ark of the Covenant then is supposed to have gone with them and gotten as far as southern Egypt. And then it was eventually taken on beyond that to a place in Ethiopia where the Ethiopic priests will tell you it is hidden in their little temple, but nobody can go in there to see it. So, you know, one becomes a little suspicious of this type of thing that, oh, you've got it, but you won't show it to me. And so this seems to me to be just another one of these apocryphal tales about the Ark of the Covenant. There is another story. There is a Seventh-day Adventist in California who had the idea, I don't know why, that the Ark of the Covenant was hidden near Hebron. And so for a time, this was several years ago, he was prospecting around Hebron, around the cave of Machpelah, around the tomb of Isaac and Jacob and no, Jacob and Rachel and Isaac and Rebecca. There are the traditional tombs there. Whether these really are their tombs or not, I'm not certain. But there's a huge long building that was built as early as the time of Herod the Great. So somewhere in that area, a little north of Hebron, is where he thought the Ark of the Covenant was hidden. Now, what are we to make of all this? We have seven different groups out looking for the Ark of the Covenant in seven different places. All of them have their own theories as to why the Ark of the Covenant was hidden in the particular place where they are looking, but not one of them, none of them, have produced any solid, tangible archaeological evidence that an archaeologist can examine that demonstrates where the Ark of the Covenant is. Therefore, if I were you, at least from my point of view, I would look upon these reports of the finding of the Ark of the Covenant with some skepticism. Now, that doesn't mean that it won't be found. I mean, I'm not opposed to them finding the Ark of the Covenant. I would like for us to really find the Ark of the Covenant. No, not just talk about finding the Ark of the Covenant. If it is found, God will bring it out in His own way, in His own time, through whatever human means or however. And until that time, I think it's best to suspend what I would call idle speculation. It may well be that the discovery could be made by accident. You know, every time they cut a road or a sewer or whatever in Israel, they open up, they find more caves. So, you see, the limestone formation of central Palestine is honeycombed with caves. And many of these have interesting archaeological artifacts in them. So it may be just from some accidental public works they will stumble upon the cave where the Ark of the Covenant was hidden. I don't know where it is. I have a suggestion of areas they might look in. I don't know if they'll find it there, but as I say, I think the most sensible approach is to suspend judgment until more tangible archaeological evidence is produced than has been produced so far. Any questions on the Ark of the Covenant? Yes. Well, that's one reason. Your question is very good. What are the laws that govern the finding of archaeological artifacts, and in particular the Ark of the Covenant? That is one reason why the Jordanians didn't want people up on Mount Nebo looking for it. They don't want the Ark of the Covenant found in Jordan because they assume this is going to create a tension. They'd probably hand it over right away. Here, take it, go. Now, this dear brother out in California that thought he knew where the Ark of the Covenant was going to put the Ark of the Covenant on a Boeing 747 and fly it back to Washington, D.C. and to present it to Neil Wilson. That would be impossible. You know, if it's found in Israel, it will be a national treasure and will probably be put in a museum or whatever. At the present time, archaeological objects other than pottery to be studied do not go out of Israel. As I mentioned yesterday, somebody's asking how the finds of an excavation are divided. And the answer is, in Jordan, we get about 50%, you know, but the Department of Antiquities has their choice. In Israel, you don't get anything. You dig it up in the country, you leave it in the country. So that would be what would happen there. I have no idea what would happen if it were found in Ethiopia. That's a little far, but the Israelis struck an airport farther south of that, so who knows? I don't know. All right. Another question or just exercising? All right, we'll let you go to supper and you can chew that one over.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.